There was a moment of dead silence. It wasn't easy to surprise a Jedi Master, but Lando had done it.
"You're getting married?"
Luke asked at last.
"To whom?"
Lando shrugged his shoulders and laughed.
"I haven't the faintest idea."
But how can you marry someone you don't know?"
"I'm not marrying a who, I'm marrying a what. I'm marrying money. What's so strange about that? People have done it since the beginning of time. A rich wife could do me a lot of good, and I could do her a lot of good, too. Make her richer, for one thing."
Luke looked at his old friend and asked a careful question. "Where do I come into all this?"
Now, that's the tricky part. I'm not altogether unknown in the galaxy. People have heard of me. Unfortunately, sometimes they haven't liked what they've heard. Some of the stories aren't even true, but they're out there just the same. I figure my candidates will know my intentions are honorable if I show up with a Jedi escort."
Luke fought hard to repress a grin.
"Wait a second. Just let me understand this. You want me to be your chaperone?"
Lando rewarded Luke with one of his most dazzling smiles.
"Exactly. Couldn't have put it better myself. With you around, I'll be respectable. They'll know I'm sincere."
"Are you sincere?"
Lando looked surprised again.
"About money? Never anything but."
"No, about marrying. What about the woman in question?"
Lando looked puzzled.
"How do you mean, what about her?"
"Well, you can't just walk up to a woman and say, 'Hello, I heard about your large bank account. Let's get married.' Why should she want to marry you? And what about love and romance and commitment and children and so on? She'll want to know where you stand on all that sort of thing."
"I really am not at all a bad catch."
Lando made a sweeping gesture.
"I have this place, not just the house, but Dometown, providing me with a nice little income. I won't need my wife's money to live on. I just use it to invest. I have a lot of experience in managing large projects and dealing with people. I have a pretty fair war record, and let's face it, I do have some connections with the powers that be on Coruscant."
"And bringing me along would remind them of all that," Luke said.
"Absolutely," Lando said, completely unabashed. "You'd make a great sales tool, even if you never said a single word."
"I see. Well, who's on your list?"
"Quite a number of people," Lando said, sounding like a salesman who wanted to be sure you knew just how impressive his stock was. "I've been working the data banks hard, doing all sorts of searches. I've come up with about 250 candidates."
250?
"That's right."
Lando pulled a portable data reader out of the pocket of his blouse.
"I certainly don't plan to visit anywhere near that many myself."
"So, who's your number one prospect?"
"A young lady by the name of Tendra Reasoned. She's a minor functionary on Sikoria, one of the outlier worlds in the Corellian sector. She's not the richest on my list, but she's wealthy enough, and her family is the real draw. They have strong contacts throughout the Corellian sector, and those connections could be worth a lot more than cash to the right sort of fellow."
"Who else?" Luke asked.
"Well, let's see."
Lando consulted the data reader.
"There's Condren Forek on Asbrion. She's a little on the young side, but her father's getting on in years."
"What's that got to do with it?" Luke asked.
"Come on, Luke. Think it through. If I'm going to marry an heiress for the money, I've got to consider how long it'll take me to collect."
"All right. Who's next on your list?"
"Well, actually, the first one I plan to visit," Lando said. "Sort of a long shot, but she's on the way to the Corellian sector, and that's where I want to end up, so I can attend the last half of the trade summit and see what deals are being made. Her name is Caria Versarian. Lives on the planet Laria Carolsil. Widow of one Chantu Sulk. He was a ship broker who made his money knowing which side to bet on in the war against the Empire, and kept his money by knowing when to change his bets."
"But this is all so ruthless. You're just looking for the woman you can make the best use of, as if you were shopping for a good deal on a land speeder."
"Well, that's the way it is in lots of cultures. They don't have much interest in true love, just marriages that can stand the test of time. Besides, the lady in question is going to be shopping for the best deal she can get. Well, that's all I'm after. A nice, honest business deal. So, what do you say? Want to come along?"
Luke hesitated. He hated to admit it, but he was tempted. He had been kind of cooped up on Coruscant for a while, and he had to confess to a certain curiosity. How the devil would Lando handle himself? It would require more gall than Luke could imagine to wander the galaxy brazenly shopping for a wife. And Mon Mothma had urged Luke to join Lando on his journey. "How many of them do I have to help you see?" Luke asked, trying to retain the last scraps of his caution.
"The first 10 on the list."
"3."
"8."
"4."
"Come on, Luke, for old time's sake." "6."
"Well, 5."
Lando's face split into a wide grin. "Great! Great, that's perfect. So, when can you be ready to go?"
Luke stood up and shrugged vaguely.
"Tomorrow morning, I guess."
Peace and quiet were rare commodities in Leia's family, and they should have been rarer still when the family was cooped up in a small ship, and yet things seemed to be going remarkably well. It was just after dinner on the first night out from Coruscant, with the Falcon due at Corellia in 2 days. Chewie was sitting at the table with his tools spread out, tinkering with some broken bit of machinery. Anakin was watching with rapt attention, offering his own advice now and again. The twins were sprawled out on the floor, both of them reading. Han was at the auxiliary control station at the aft end of the lounge, doing some sort of check on the Falcon's systems. Leia was seated at the far end of the table from Chewbacca and Anakin. In theory, she too was reading, giving herself the rare treat of curling up with a good book. Instead, she found herself basking in the moment of family, all safe, all well, and all happy to be together.
"What's it like, Daddy?"
Jaina asked, looking up from her book.
"What's what like, Princess?"
Han asked, turning around in his swivel seat.
"Corellia, what's it like?"
Jaina climbed up into her father's lap. Jason stayed where he was, sitting cross-legged on the floor, but Anakin took his cue from Jaina. He hopped down from where he was sitting next to Chewie and climbed up into his mother's lap. Han put on his best storytelling voice.
"It's a beautiful place. The Corellian sector is made up of a couple of dozen star systems, but the most important one in the sector is the Corellian star system. The central star of that system is called Corell. And the most important planet in the Corellian star system, in the Corellian sector, is Corellia. And the capital city is Coronet. Now, one of the most interesting things about the Corellian star system is that it has so many inhabited planets. It's rare for a star to have even one planet that people can live on. The Corellian system has 5 habitable planets, the 5 brothers, we call them."
"But why are there 5 habitable planets?" Jason asked.
"Good question," Han said. "The planets' orbits are so close to each other that some of the scientists think the whole star system is artificial. They think somebody built it a long, long time ago."
"Wow," said Jason. "Somebody built a whole star system?"
"Well, that's one idea. But if the 5 brothers were put in their current orbits on purpose, it must have happened in the dimmest mists of time, even before the dawn of the Old Republic, more than 1,000 generations ago. The next thing you need to know is that there are more than just humans in the Corellian sector. There are the Salonians and the Drawl, lots of them, and a few of all sorts of other kinds of beings. At least there used to be. All 3 species live in Coronet, and species from 100 other star systems besides. They all come to Coronet to buy and sell and trade. At least they used to. We don't really know what things are like now."
"Why not?" Jaina asked.
"Well, it's tricky," Leia said. "We have a lot of general information about what's going on in Corellia, but it's very hard to get solid detail on a lot of things.
Even in the old days, you had to do a lot of guessing if you were studying Corellia," said Han. "It's always been sort of inward-looking, not much worried about the outside. And don't forget that half the galaxy is still recovering from the Imperial Alliance War. Corellia has probably taken its lumps along with everyone else, even if we don't get much of that from the reports we get. So we might find out it's the beautiful, well-run planet we hear about, the kind of place it was when I lived there. Or we might discover it's a hard-scrabble sort of place with lots of problems."
"I don't want to go to any place that's all crummy," Jason said.
"But it might do you some good if you did," Han said.
Your mother and I both feel it'd be good for you to see something of life besides the cushy deal you have on Coruscant. You should see how the other half lives. After all, it's how your parents lived not all that long ago.
Were you guys poor and stuff?
I always was, Han said. And your mother, well, she lost everything she ever had in the war.
That was an understatement, Leia thought. The Empire had destroyed her entire planet for no better reason than to terrify the rest of the galaxy.
Anyway, Han went on, let me tell you about the Drahl and the Salonians. An adult Drahl is about as tall as you are, Jason, but a lot heavier set. They have short brown or black or gray fur, or sometimes red. They look a little like taller, thinner Ewoks with shorter fur, but their heads are completely different, rounder, more intelligent-looking to human eyes, with a bit more pronounced muzzle, and with their ears flat to the head instead of sticking up. They are very dignified, very sensible beings, and they expect to be treated with respect. Is that clear?
Han looked around and made sure he got a nod out of all three kids.
Good, he went on. I won't have to warn you to take the Salonians seriously, because you'll know to do that 5 seconds after you see one. They are big and strong and quick, the average adult a bit taller than me. Most humans think they are a very refined-looking species. They're bipeds like humans and Drahl, but they have long, slender bodies, and they can go on all fours if they want to. They have sleek, short fur and long, pointed faces with bristly whiskers and very sharp teeth and long tails, just right for whapping you if you don't behave. They live underground, mostly, and they're very good swimmers. But there's one other thing you should know about them. Chances are the only ones you'll ever see are going to be sterile females, and it's always a sterile female who's the boss. All their males, and all the females who can have children, have to stay at home in the dens all the time.
That doesn't sound very fair, Jaina said.
No, it doesn't, to a human, Han said. Maybe it doesn't even sound that fair to some of the Salonians, but that's the way their society works. Anyway, there are the three main Corellian species. Every now and then a group from one world decides to move to one of the other worlds, so they pack up and off they go. Then the next day, or 1,000 years later, another group on another of the brothers will decide to move, and off they go. Nowadays, all of the worlds are all scrambled up, with all of the species on all of them. Sometimes it's just one kind of people, humans or Salonians or Drahl in one town. Other places, like in Coronet, all three of the species live there. Not only them, but beings from 100 other star systems besides. They all come to Coronet to buy and sell and trade.
Han hesitated a moment, and a look of sadness came over his face.
At least there used to be that many traders from the outside. Things have changed because of the war.
How did the war make you change? Anakin asked.
Han thought for a moment before he answered. Even before the war really got started, the Navy found it harder and harder to keep enough patrol craft out in the space lanes. They kept getting called away to chase this bunch of rebel raiders, or to show the flag in that outpost, or to deal with other crises. The more the Navy wasn't there, the more the raiders and pirates showed up. The more the pirates chased the traders, the less worthwhile it was for the traders to do business. And when the traders went away, the trading went away too, and lots of people in the Corellian sector got poorer and poorer.
And then the war itself came, Leia said, and the Emperor's Corellian government got scared, not just scared of the rebellion, but scared of everyone. They decided the safest thing to do was not to trust anyone at all. They decided they didn't want the traitors. In fact, they didn't want any outsiders, and the Corellian leaders stopped trusting their own people and put more and more of the same sort of restrictions on them. And with the Imperial government propping up the Corellian diktat, that's what they called their chief of state, the diktat could do whatever he wanted without any fear of the people protesting.
But you guys won the war a long time ago, Jason said. Without the Empire, didn't the diktat guy have to quit?
Leia smiled at that. If only the universe were that tidy, that sensible, so that the losers knew when it was time to quit and gave up once it was over.
The diktat never did quit, Leia said. Not in the way you mean. But once there was no more Empire to provide outside support, people started to be less and less afraid. They started doing what they wanted instead of what the rules said they should do. The more people got away with breaking the rules, the braver they got, and the more rules they broke. The security forces didn't feel brave enough to stop it all, and they didn't want to go on shooting their own people. It all just sort of collapsed. The diktat was still there in his palace, giving out orders and demanding that people be executed, but no one listened anymore, and no one obeyed his orders. We were still trying to decide what to do with him when he disappeared, and we think he was taken off to one of the outlier systems.
What are outliers? Anakin asked.
That's the name for the star systems in the Corellian sector that are sort of small and far away from Corell itself, Leia said. Lots of people from the sector's imperial government ran off to them and just dropped out of sight. The Republic installed a new sector governor-general, a Frosian, by the name of Macamberlecto. But when the Corellians held local elections, a lot of the old imperial types got back into office.
So this governor-general Macamberlecto is a good guy who has a lot of bad guys working for him, and he can't do anything about it, Jason said.
So how are you and Dad planning to fix it all? Jaina asked. That question threw Leia for a loop.
Not directly. If we went in and threw out all the officials we didn't like, we'd be just as bad as the Empire. But part of the idea of the trade summit is to make things tough for the bad guys in the future. We're hoping that if we can get trade going again, people won't have so many troubles for the wrong sort of candidate to exploit.
Gone. There could be no further doubt. Luke Skywalker was gone. Farnus Gleesri, agent of the Human League, could no longer deceive himself. The Jedi Master had not been home for at least a full day, and Lando Calrissian's ship, the Lady Luck, was no longer in its usual berth. It seemed most likely that they had gone off together. Farnus knew there was nothing for it but to follow the backup plan, as dicey as it might be. He would have to use the message probe, and hope against hope that Jade's Fire stayed to its shipping schedule. Otherwise, the hidden leader was not going to be best pleased. And that was not a pleasant thought.
Did you have to bring them along? Lando asked, not for the first time.
The objects of his complaint, the droids R2-D2 and C-3PO, were on the opposite side of the Lady Luck's wardroom, and neither of them seemed to be any happier to be with Lando than Lando was to be with them. 3PO answered before Luke even had a chance.
I assure you, Captain Calrissian, that my counterpart and I have demonstrated the highest degree of utility on any number of occasions. I might add that I, in particular, will doubtless be of the greatest possible use on a mission of romance. In addition to being familiar with over 6 million forms of communication, I am well versed in the courtship rituals of 2,047 human cultures, as well as 516 non-human cultures.
Put a lid on it, Lando said. The day I ask your advice on how to treat a lady is the day I take a vow of chastity.
Take it easy, R2, Luke said. No need to be quite that insulting. He smiled. Every time I've brought the two of them along, I've been glad, Lando. Trust me, they'll come in handy.
Well, they better do it fast, otherwise they're going to keep an appointment with the spare parts bin.
Come on, take it easy. Besides, you've got another appointment to keep first. We should be breaking out of hyperspace and into the Lariar Kelsil system any time now. Lando glanced at the chronometer.
Another 15 minutes or so, he said as he stood up. We ought to go forward to the cockpit.
3PO took a step forward as if to follow, but Lando held up his hand.
Hold it right there, golden boy. You two stay safely locked up and out of the way here in the wardroom while we're flying the ship and while we're planetside. Is that clear?
3PO watched as the hatch slid shut behind the two humans and was astonished to hear the click of a bolt sliding to. Captain Calrissian had locked them in.
Well, he said. What? No, I didn't catch the name of the place we're going. No one ever tells me anything. Well, if you knew we were going to Lariar Kelsil, why did you bother asking me? Oh, you mean I could look up what I have concerning Lariar Kelsil? Well, why didn't you say so?
3PO paused, accessing his data memory.
Oh, dear. Oh, my. R2, whatever are we going to do?
At first glance, at least, Lariar Kelsil seemed like a rather pleasant place to Lando.
The sky was a crystal blue with fluffy white clouds riding a freshening breeze. The air smelled pure and clean. A 5-minute ride in a hover car brought them into the center of town. And a handsome-looking center of town it was. Waist-high trees with pale blue bark and small round purple leaves lined the neatly kept avenues.
"Not bad," Lando said as the two of them walked along. "Not bad at all. I could see this as a very nice little base of operations."
"You're getting a bit ahead of yourself. Wouldn't it be better to wait until you had met the lady in question?"
"Hurry, hurry! Burn it open if you have to, you miserable bucket of bolts!"
3PO shouted at R2. The little astromech unit was struggling to get the wardroom hatch open. And then the door slid halfway open, just far enough for the two of them to get out of the wardroom.
"Good work, R2. Oh, why couldn't Captain Calrissian or Master Luke be carrying a comlink so we could warn them?"
Lando and Luke arrived at Caria Versarian's house just a minute or two before the appointed time. Her house was hard to miss in that quiet tree-lined street. It was by far the largest house in the neighborhood. Nearly all the other homes were made out of a sort of dark yellow brick or occasionally bluish-gray wood, but Versarian's house was built of well-mortared dark gray stone. It was 5 stories tall, although all the other nearby buildings were 2 or 3 stories at most. The grounds were surrounded by a high fence made up of decorative black iron bars. It looked more like a fortress than a home. Luke noticed that the houses on either side of Versarian's house were empty and abandoned, their grounds overgrown with brambles in stark contrast to the elaborate gardens and private menageries on display everywhere else. Something was not right. Luke reached out with the Force and tried to get an impression of the house, a feel for the mood of the people. He could sense only one sentient mind there. It had to be Versarian. It was abundantly clear that she did not regard herself as dangerous, but as quite the opposite. Luke sensed an almost cloying benevolence, someone overeager to do good for anyone and everyone, whether they liked it or not. The solid-looking steel door swung open to reveal a strikingly lovely young woman. She was tall, slender, and dark-skinned, with eyes of the most startling deep violet. She was dressed in a simple, elegant black dress, and a single large diamond hung around her neck on a platinum chain.
"Welcome to you both," the woman said. "I am Caria Versarian, and it is the greatest of honors to welcome you into my humble abode."
One look at Lando, and it was obvious that the size of the bankroll that would entice him to marry her had just shrunk rather precipitously. The ground floor of the house seemed to be one vast room. Folding screens and freestanding shelves and display cases broke the space up into a number of cozy-looking sitting areas. Comfortable-looking couches and chairs and luxurious carpets were arranged invitingly. It looked to be the sort of room made for a splendid party, not for sheltering one lone widow.
"Come," said Caria Versarian. "Do sit yourselves down and make yourselves as you would be at home."
Lando Calrissian could not have been happier. He should have thought of this getting married business years ago. Here he was, first try out of the box, and as far as he could tell, well on his way to a very satisfactory arrangement. Even after only a few minutes of small talk, he and Caria were getting along wonderfully. She was not only rich, she was charming. Luke was the only fly in the ointment. He was being polite enough, but he seemed distracted, distant.
Caria leaned forward on the arm of her chair, and her face took on a more earnest expression.
"I am glad of all this pleasant talk, but the folk who come to me oft-times have but little time to spare. I find that I prefer coming to the point most quickly. Would that be suitable to you?"
Lando smiled, just a trifle uncertainly, and nodded.
"Absolutely."
"That is good. It is plain that you have made inquiries concerning me, else you would not have come. I have made inquiries of my own. One thing I have not been able to learn from my investigations. It would seem that you are in quite good health. Is this the case?"
"Why, yes. Yes, of course."
Lando was clearly taken aback.
"Lots of good years left in me."
Caria leaned back in her chair.
"And yet you are here. Most interesting."
"Not unheard of."
"And yet most interesting."
She looked at Lando hard in the face for a long moment, clearly trying to reach a decision.
"I like you," she finally said. "I will have you, if you will have me."
"Well, I, any man would be honored to accept you, my dear Lady Caria. But surely we must agree to terms before we complete the, marriage agreement."
"Well and wisely put, gentle sir. Marry me and live with me. I will fully support you in all ways for 5 years, longer than is normal."
"You'll support me?"
Lando had heard the emphasis on the word support.
"Support me in what way?"
Caria smiled as if it were a silly question.
"In all ways. I will care for your health, provide for you financially, clothe you, feed you, and shelter you."
"And in return?"
"And in return, you will live well."
"Well, that certainly seems fair enough," Lando said. "But let me make something clear. I don't want or intend just to live off you. I want to make things, build things, run things."
"Yes, of course. That is your gift. You must pursue it. You seek a source of investment capital, and that I shall be for you. Will that be satisfactory?"
"Yes, of course. Absolutely," Lando said.
No one had ever offered him terms like these before.
Caria stood up. "Then let us perform the ceremony. Life is short, and delay is death."
"Lando, wait a second," Luke said. "There's something wrong here. I don't know what it is, but there is something wrong."
Lando grabbed Luke by the arm and pulled him close.
"Luke, back off. This is what I was after. Don't mess this up for me."
Caria gestured toward a five-sided red canopy that stood at the south side of the great room.
"There. We stand under the canopy, activate a recording device, repeat a brief oath in front of a witness, perform the blood kiss, and the deed is done."
"Blood kiss?"
Lando asked a bit anxiously.
Caria smiled. "A most lurid name for a most gentle ritual. A pinprick on your right forefinger, a spot of blood. I kiss it. You do the same to me, and that is all. We will be wed."
The cab driver had made one wrong turn and corrected it with a U-turn of remarkable violence. Now, at last, the droids were in front of the Versarian house. 3PO suddenly realized that R2 could not get out of the hover car without assistance, and yet was blocking the door. 3PO tapped on the scuffed, clear plastic barrier that divided the front seat from the back.
"Driver, I'm afraid I must ask your help to get my counterpart back out of the cruiser."
The driver turned around and glared at 3PO most unpleasantly.
"Come on, you crazy tin box. It was tough enough getting him into the cab back at the spaceport."
The driver popped open the door to the driving compartment, got out, opened the rear door, slapped one meaty hand on either side of R2, and pulled him out of the cab with a single mighty heave. He dumped R2 unceremoniously on the grass by the side of the road.
"Well, I can't say that I'm sorry to see the last of him. Come along, R2, we must hurry."
They stood under the red canopy, and haunting music played from some hidden source. A single red candle stood on a low five-sided table at the exact center of the canopy and burned with a strange blue flame. Caria lifted her hands and offered them palm down to Lando, one hand on either side of the candle. Lando placed his hands over hers, close enough to the candle that the blue flame cast its light on his skin.
"Left hand in right hand in left," she began. "East to west to east. Sunrise facing sunset, as dusk faces dawn. Life shorter than a moment. Life longer than memory. Two shall be one, and one shall be all."
She nodded to him, indicating that he should repeat the words, which he did. She reached down onto the table and picked up an instrument with an elaborately carved handle resembling a ceremonial dagger. But this dagger had no blade. Instead, it had a 10-centimeter needle, its point so sharp it was hard to see. She stuck the needle's point into the candle's flame, which flared from bright blue to glowing ruddy red. Now she held Lando's forefinger between her thumb and forefinger, raised the needle dagger, and... There was a sudden violent pounding at the door. "Hold it," Luke said. Whatever that was might provide a way to stall. He unclipped his lightsaber, just to be on the safe side, threw back the bolt, and pulled the door open. "3PO! What in space are you..." "Stop! Stop! Stop!" 3PO burst into the room. He paused a moment as he looked around, and then spotted Lando and Caria under the canopy. He hurried toward them, gesticulating frantically.
"Go no further, Captain Calrissian. The woman is a life witch!"
"That is a term that I do not like to hear," said Caria. "We call ourselves life-bearers, for that is truly what we do."
3PO turned toward Caria.
"Tell them we have the records. Tell them how many times you have been married."
Caria ignored 3PO and addressed Lando with an unnerving calm.
"Ours is a special gift and skill. By linking close, we can keep the old, the sick, the dying alive for a time. The blood kiss bonds my body chemistry to my husband's. I can link to his life essence and so sustain him. We can hold back pain and forestall death, but only for a time. Then we must withdraw support or die ourselves."
"You mean, after 5 years of supporting me..."
"I would withdraw support, and you would die."
Caria shrugged.
"I thought that you knew this. You would not be the first young and healthy man to exchange a long and uncertain life for a short one of comfort and security."
Lando managed to gasp out a single question.
"How many husbands?"
She drew herself up to her full height, folded her arms, and spoke with a calm, low dignity.
"I shall conceal nothing. I have had the honor to survive 49 husbands thus far. Should you still wish to undergo the ceremony, it shall be your happy death 5 years from today. That will bring it to an even 50.
Something was happening to the apparently ordinary star that astronomers referred to as star number TD10036EM1271. It was something that went against all experience, all patterns of stellar mechanics. Strange forces reached out for it. Huge and unseen hands manipulated its interior, forcing the internal heat and pressure up to levels that such a star never experienced. The surface of TD10036EM1271 began to roil more and more violently. Powerful seismic waves started to pulse through the supercompressed matter at the star's core. Its outer layers began to expand as a result of the increased heat and pressure. And then, quite impossibly, the star exploded. The shockwave shell of energy rushed out into space in all directions, an incredible blast of light and heat that would be plainly visible to the naked eye from a half dozen inhabited systems, once the light from the explosion reached those stars years or decades later. But the event did not go unobserved. By something more than chance, an automated probe droid was on hand to witness the explosion. It carefully recorded every detail of the supernova. Then it powered down its detection systems and switched on its navicomputer. It dropped out of normal space and rushed into the dark between the stars. It had an appointment to keep. An appointment on Corellia. Han Solo had gone to sleep, happy indeed. After tucking the children in, he had gone to be by himself and shut his own eyes, thinking nostalgic thoughts about his old home world. He had felt full of love and pride in his children, felt glad that everyone was safe and secure aboard the good old Millennium Falcon. But all of that good feeling vanished as he slept. Han was tormented by dreams that night, fearsome dreams of all the most nightmarish moments of his old adventures, the monsters that had tried to kill him, the deadly traps he had been caught in, and by all rights should not have escaped. But the real dangers he had faced in the past paled in comparison with the imaginary terror Han faced in his dreams that night. Again and again he found himself trapped in the same few horrifying moments. Something, a faceless, deadly secret, was stalking Han and his family, tracking them across a lurid, distorted jungle landscape. His eyes snapped open, and Han realized that he was awake, safe in his berth on his ship, with Leia by his side, and all was well. He was suddenly aware that he was covered with cold sweat. He got up and made his way out to the passageway to a refresher stall and splashed water on his face. What in the universe had he been thinking of, bringing Leia and the kids to such a place?
"Ah, give it up,"
Han said to the face in the mirror. Leia would have gone anyway to attend the trade summit, and Han knew full well just how determined she was to keep her family with her. And yet, that NRI agent had known more than she was telling, or perhaps telling more than she knew. Something wasn't right. Han was certain of that. Han checked the Navicomputer's countdown clock again, only a few more minutes until the drop out of hyperspace. Short of pulling into a space dock and doing visual checks, they were as ready as they were going to be. And so, presumably, were their friends in Corellia. Han made a decision.
Chewie, we're going to drop out of hyperspace 20 seconds early.
I don't care how far it takes us out of the arrival zone. I'd rather be off course than pop into normal space lined up in some pirate's crosshairs. Han pushed the lightspeed control levers forward just as the clock hit the 20-second mark. The universe reappeared as the viewport filled with star lines that rapidly downshifted into the familiar points of light, the stars of Corellia, the stars of home. The comm system lit up.
Unknown vehicle, you are in a restricted area. This is Corellia Traffic Control. Identify immediately.
Han responded with the little white lie he had at the ready.
Corellia Traffic Control, this is Millennium Falcon. We had a slight navigational error. Now preparing to proceed to designated entry coordinates.
There was a slight pause before they got an answer.
Very well, Millennium Falcon. Proceed at standard transit velocity to designated rendezvous coordinates and hold there for further instructions.
Rendezvous coordinates? They weren't supposed to rendezvous with anyone. Did someone on Corellia have a surprise waiting for them?
We'll comply, Corellia Traffic Control.
He confirmed the Falcon's fix on the planet Corellia, a gleaming blue and white marble in the sky, did an offset calculation to the rendezvous coordinates, and lit the sublight engines.
There we go, Chewie. On course for target point. Let's see if there's a reception committee.
But Chewie already had the long-range passive scanners doing a sweep, and the sweep didn't have to work very hard to find something. Centered exactly on the Falcon's designated entry coordinates were no fewer than 6 faint blips in a spherical formation. If the Falcon had come in where she had been supposed to, she would have been surrounded.
Han whistled softly. That's some rendezvous. But is it an honor guard for the Chief of State? Or did someone get the bright idea of arresting Leia? Well, yeah, it could be me they want to arrest, but those warrants should have expired years ago. All right, then. They're getting data from Corellia Traffic Control. But I bet they think we have the standard commercial grid we're registered as having. And if they don't know how good our detectors are, they'll think we can't see them from way out here. So, what do they do when they can see us and think we can't see them?
He watched for a moment and got his answer.
They move, he announced to Chewie, even though the Wookiee was watching the same image on his own screen. They move right toward us. And that doesn't tell us a thing. Honor Guard or bandits would do the same thing. Chewie, cut main engines and give me rear detectors fast.
Normally, Han would have simply spun the ship around to bring the forward detector array to bear. But with a fleet of 6 armed and possibly trigger-happy ships of questionable motive bearing down on him, it did not seem to be the time for violent maneuvers. The sublight engines died with a low groan, which was normal, and a sudden thud, which was not.
Then the rear detector came online, and suddenly what Han had hoped was just a problem with the sublight engines wasn't on the top of the list anymore. There was more company coming to visit, and it was coming at high speed, straight for the Falcon. There were 3 of them, close enough that Han could get a visual on them. 3 uglies, he shouted. Dead astern! I hate uglies!
Uglies were an unpleasant little specialty of the less reputable of the Corellian shipyards, patch-up jobs cobbled together from whatever wrecks happened to find their way into the scrap heap. By the looks of them, two of the things, Han could not bring himself to call them fighters or ships, had started out life as X-wings. Now, however, the wings themselves had been stripped off, and the side shields from a pair of early model TIE fighters were welded on. The third ugly wasn't even that recognizable. It had a cockpit section from a Corellian stock light freighter, one of the Falcon's sister ships, bolted onto the fuselage of a badly damaged B-wing, with a turbo laser cannon slung under the ship's belly. Only the real dregs of Corellian space flew uglies. Down on their luck pirates, mercenaries who would change sides in the middle of a battle if the price was right, losers who had nothing left to lose, and people who did not wish to be identified.
Chewie, you're going to have to fly her. I'll take the upper quad laser turret.
Han hit the hatch open button and was on the other side of the hatchway before the thing was half open. He jammed the headset on and powered up the turret.
Chewie, I've got him on visual. Not quite in range yet, and I want it to stay that way.
With the kids on board, he was more interested in running than duking it out with a bunch of uglies, and maybe the honor guard, too, if they turned out to be less than honorable. He swung the turret gun around and got a tracking lock on the first X-TIE fighter. He was about to fire when the Falcon suddenly pitched around, a hard 90-degree rotation. Chewie was lining up the ship on a trajectory that would get them out from among these ships. Good. But then nothing happened. Han had learned from bitter experience what nothing happening meant at such times. He looked up the accessway panel just in time to see Chewie rushing past the base of the passage, headed for the sublight engine access panels. The tactical display was preparing an automated firing run, but Han slapped it over to manual. He didn't trust a computer to do his fighting for him. The B-wing ugly was getting closer. Han held his fire for just a fraction of a second longer than he wanted, letting the B-wing get fully into range. Then he let it have a long volley of fire. He caught it with a nice series of hits amidships as it swept past, swinging the quad laser turret around to pound another volley into its sublight engines. One of the portside engines flared suddenly and then went dark. Han swung the turret back around to take a crack at the X-TIE uglies and suddenly realized they had flown past with the B-wing, flying outboard to it. They had all flown right past him. They had ignored him altogether. None of them had fired at all. With a sudden lurch that made itself felt, artificial grav system or no, the sublight engines came back online, and there was Chewie hot-footing it back to the cockpit. Han allowed himself a half-moment's regret that he hadn't put Leia on the quad lasers. That way he could have stayed in the cockpit while Chewie ran back and forth on repair duty. Too late for that idea now, and besides, someone had to watch the children. A half-moan, half-growl coming through the headset told Han that Chewie was back at the flight controls. There was another hard jerk as the Wookiee slammed the sublight engines back on at full power, and Han struggled to keep track of the uglies as they headed straight for what he could now see were the pocket patrol boats of the Honor Guard. The Millennium Falcon took off at right angles to the line between the uglies and the Honor Guard, but something was wrong, very wrong. Neither the uglies nor the Honor Guard was paying the Falcon the slightest attention.
Chewie, full stop! Cut the engines, do a 180-degree turn, reverse thrust, and hold us here.
The ship lurched again, and the Falcon came about to its new heading. Han checked to make sure the tactical display was being recorded, then zoomed the view to get a good close look at the uglies. They were opening fire on the Falcon from a much poorer firing angle, with 20 times the distance of their closest approach, with the element of surprise gone, and with the Honor Guard patrol boats, if they were an Honor Guard, just about to jump on them. But why? Why? A volley of near misses from the B-wing's ground laser blazed past the Falcon, bouncing off the shields and rattling the ship. It was close, but it should have been much closer.